Well, let's get started with non-messianic predictions. There are some predictions that speak directly of Christ, which we studied last week. And tonight we're going to dive into predictions that are not about Jesus, but which are predictive. They're prophetic of future events. Well, let's get started with the first one. The first one is the destruction of Tyre in Ezekiel 26. Ezekiel writes, "They will destroy the walls of Tyre and tear down its towers. I will scrape away its soil and make it a bare rock. It will be just a rock in the sea, a place for fishermen to spread their nets. For I have spoken, says the sovereign Lord. Tyre will become the prey of many nations." Now, later in this prophecy, Ezekiel is going to go on to explain that God is going to primarily work through Nebuchadnezzar. In the subsequent passages, we're going to read that God uses Nebuchadnezzar to take down Tyre, the city that was against Israel. But I want you to remember, here in verse 5, he says that you will actually become the prey of many nations, not just Babylon, not just Nebuchadnezzar. Well, verse 6, "Its mainland villages will be destroyed by the sword. From the north, I will bring King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon against Tyre. He is king of kings and brings his horses, chariots, charioteers, and great army." Well, later on in chapter 29, verse 18, Ezekiel points out, quote, "Yet Nebuchadnezzar and his army won no plunder to compensate them for all of their work." So even though he says God is going to come in with King Nebuchadnezzar to bring judgment against Tyre, first, he's going to bring Nebuchadnezzar, but Nebuchadnezzar is not going to finish the job. He's not even going to be able to plunder that city because the people of Tyre are going to escape. Well, verse 8 says, "He, Nebuchadnezzar, will destroy your mainland villages. Then he will attack you by building a siege wall, constructing a ramp and raising a roof of shields against you." And then verses 9 through 11 go on to describe the siege of Nebuchadnezzar. But then verse 12, interestingly, switches over to "they." "They will destroy your lovely homes and dump your stones and timbers and even your dust into the sea. I will make your island a bare rock, a place for fishermen to spread their nets. You will never be rebuilt, for I, the Lord, have spoken." Yes, the sovereign Lord has spoken. So it's interesting here. He's predicting the complete destruction of Tyre, not just by Nebuchadnezzar, but by many nations are going to actually destroy the city and, for some reason, in an odd way, throw the things in Tyre into the sea. Well, Ezekiel wrote this book in 587 B.C., 587 B.C. Even critics of the Bible agree that Ezekiel wrote this book in the 6th century B.C. This is not one of the books that higher criticism has gone after. Robert Manweiler writes in his chapter out of the book, The Evidence of Prophecy, "Ezekiel is probably the most carefully dated of all Old Testament books. We here note that the majority of biblical scholars, even those who reject the inspiration and unity of the Bible, believe most of the book was written in the 6th century B.C. by the prophet Ezekiel." So you see what he's saying. Even critics of the Bible agree that this is a 6th century book. Gleason Archer, in his book, A Survey of the Old Testament Introduction, says that some of the rash critics on the far outliers of scholarship will place this book at 400 B.C. That's about as far as they possibly go. But there's good evidence to believe that this is a very early book, as it claims. Manweiler writes, "The prophecy against Tyre in chapter 26 can be dated with great probability at least 2 centuries before its fulfillment." Secondly, we can point out, Nebuchadnezzar came through and attacked old Tyre for 13 years, between 585 and 573 B.C. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us that. Well, I guess it does. But in addition to the Bible telling us that, Josephus, a non-believer, and against Appian, describes that Nebuchadnezzar attacked the city for 13 years, but he was unsuccessful in plundering the city. He broke through old Tyre, the city that was on the land, but as he broke through, the people of Tyre took off in their navy and went over to New Tyre, or what is sometimes referred to as Insular Tyre. They went about a half mile off the coast to an island that was right there by the city's edge. So Nebuchadnezzar came through the gates only to find that they had escaped to a city a half mile off the coast. Thirdly, we can point out, 200 years later, after this happened, none other than Alexander the Great came through the ancient world to destroy Tyre, which was now New Tyre. It had moved off of the coast into that little island. Here's a picture. We have a picture of New Tyre off to the west there, and Old Tyre was defeated by Nebuchadnezzar to the east. So Alexander the Great came through. Now, Alexander didn't want to keep going through the ancient world onto Egypt without completely decimating Tyre, because they were a powerful force to be reckoned with. He didn't want to keep moving on into Egypt only to have his back turned against Tyre. So he wanted to completely decimate New Tyre. There's just one problem. Alexander didn't have a navy. He didn't have a navy to get across that half mile stretch out into New Tyre. Now, there was a sandbank of sediment that had built underneath the water about 2 meters down, between a meter and 2 meters down. So there was a little bit of sand there, but it was just filled with water, and he couldn't bring his troops across. Well, if you know anything about Alexander the Great, to call him type A would be an understatement, okay? So if he didn't have a navy, and he didn't want to send his troops swimming across, what do you suppose Alexander did? Well, he built a causeway going directly up against this city. Well, what do you suppose Alexander the Great used to build this causeway? He went through and he stripped old Tyre, as the prophecy predicted. He stripped the buildings, the metal, the stone, the brick. He had his men throw this into the Mediterranean Sea and build a causeway out to New Tyre. As Ezekiel said in verse 12, dump your stones and timbers and even your dust into the sea. I will make your island a bare rock, a place for fishermen to spread their nets. To this day, fishermen spread their nets on Old Tyre because there's just nothing there. And this causeway is still built. It's still there to this day. Not only did Ezekiel predict this, Zechariah predicted it in chapter 9, verse 4, where he says, but now the Lord will strip away Tyre's possessions and hurl its fortifications into the sea, and it will be burned to the ground. Moreover, Isaiah in chapter 23 also predicted the same thing. So what we have is not just one prophet describing this destruction. We have correlation. We have three separate prophets at three separate times all saying this is going to happen, all of which wrote before Alexander lived or died. Alexander died in 323 BC. It's fourth century, way after these guys wrote this prediction. So that's the destruction of Tyre. Pretty interesting prediction. Then we have the destruction of Edom, Jeremiah 49, verses 16 and 17, where Jeremiah writes this. As for the terror of you, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. O you who live in the clefts of the rock, who occupy the height of the hill. Edom was a fortress that was built right into the side of a cliff. They were impenetrable. You couldn't get at this fortress. Well, even though it was impenetrable, Jeremiah predicted, though you make your nest as high as an eagle's, I will bring you down from there, declares the Lord. Edom will become an object of horror. Everyone who passes by it will be horrified and will hiss at all its wounds. Again, not only did Jeremiah predict this, but Joel predicted the same thing in chapter 3, verses 19. Verse 19. They both predicted this. This came to fruition finally, though many people went after the city, came to fruition finally in the 7th century as Muslim conquerors came through and destroyed Edom. Today, it's a place for tourism where people come and witness the former city of Edom. It's been completely decimated. Number three, we have the destruction of Babylon, predicted again, not just in one place, but in two separate places by two separate prophets. Isaiah 13:19 reads, "And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there." That's a very specific prediction. This is going to be destroyed, and it will not be inhabited from generation to generation. Jeremiah 51, verse 24, "But I will repay Babylon and all the inhabitants of Chaldea for all their evil that they have done in Zion before your eyes, declares the Lord. They will not take from you even a stone, nor a cornerstone, or a stone for foundations, but you will be desolate." How long? Forever. You will be desolate forever. And they won't lift stones out of your city. Robert Newman, out of the book In Defense of Miracles, writes this. He says, "Even today, Arabs are afraid to live at the site of Babylon, and its soil is too poor to provide grass for grazing. Shepherds don't bring their sheep there." Moreover, he writes, "Even more amazing is the fact that Babylon is currently quarried for its brick, but not for its stone, which is burned to lime to make mortar, as Jeremiah predicted. Not a stone will be lifted from it." A modern day Iraqi tour guide website writes this, "Today Babylon lies completely in ruins. A large and splendidly carved stone lion is all that remains of its former glories." So this city has been permanently put down as God predicted. Then we have another prediction. Straight off the lips of Jesus Christ, straight from Jesus' mouth, Jesus predicted scandalously that his message of love and forgiveness was actually going to reach the entire globe. In Matthew 24:14, we read, "This gospel," or good news of the kingdom, "shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." So Jesus predicted that the entire globe would hear about his message of love and forgiveness. He says it two different ways: the whole world and all ethnoi, all nations, all ethnic groups. Now, you have to think about this for a second. Imagine if you were one of Jesus' disciples. You're sitting with him on the Mount Olivet as he makes this prediction. You're looking around at a dozen other guys that are still following him at this point. A week later, he's strung up and butchered like an animal and he's crucified. And yet he claimed that his message would reach the entire globe. Are you kidding? And yet 2,000 years later, what we found is that 2/3 of the world has heard of Jesus Christ's message. That comes from a very reliable group called the Joshua Project. They place it at about 59% of people on earth have heard about Jesus Christ. So 2,000 years later, this has come to fruition. Then our final non-messianic prophecy, one that I find incredible, absolutely amazing, is the regathering of Israel. I went through and counted up all of the passages that predict this. I lost count. There was more than about 20 different prophecies from different prophets throughout the Hebrew Bible, all of which predict that at the end of human history, the nation of Israel will be physically, nationally regathered. First of all, Isaiah predicts it. Isaiah 11:11, we read, "Then it will happen on that day." If you read the context, this is at the end of human history. "It will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people, who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And he will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Now, first thing we need to point out here, Isaiah was writing before the first dispersion, before the Babylonian takeover. So when he says that God will recover a second time, he's referring, of course, to a time after the regathering under Ezra and Nehemiah, which we studied if you were here for the book of Daniel, Daniel 9, that whole time period, about 530, somewhere in there, or 517, to be specific. So when Isaiah says to regather a second time, he's not referring to the regathering under Ezra and Nehemiah, but another regathering in the future. Moreover, Isaiah uses specific language to describe that this will not be a national regathering in the ancient Near East, but it will be a global, universal regathering. He says, from the islands of the sea, from the four corners of the earth. We're talking about a universal, global regathering of Israel. When the Jews finally came back out of Babylon and Persia, that was only 52,000 Jews coming from around the surrounding nations. They didn't go that far. But to come from the four corners of the earth, the islands of the sea, that's global. Well, in the last 50 years, what we found, in the last 60 years, what we found is that the nation of Israel, beyond all odds, all probability, has been globally regathered into its original real estate, its original plot of land. In 1948, after the horrors of World War II, the United Nations had pity on the Jews for being men and women without a country. They had nowhere to actually go to. This is where a lot of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories have come from. When the people throughout Europe were looking at the Jews, they were saying, who are these Jews? Where do they belong? You know, they're not Russians, but they're in Russia. They're not Germans, but they're in Germany. Where do they belong? And all these conspiracy theories arose because they thought that the Jews were in charge of the world and that they were trying to infiltrate. And that's where a lot of this anti-Semitism came from. Well, after 1948, the United Nations gave Israel a plot of land. And since 1948, what we've found is a global evacuation of Jews from these different areas that Isaiah describes here back into Israel. Let's go through just a few of these nations that Isaiah predicts specifically. He says that they'll come from Assyria. In 1948, there were roughly 150,000 Jews in Assyria. Today, there are 10. No, I didn't say 10,000, 1,000. 10. There's 10 Jewish people in modern day Iraq, Assyria. You can get that from the virtualjewishlibrary.org. A handful of Jews, 150,000 flooded out of Iraq and are now back in Israel. What about Egypt? 1948, there were 66,000 Jews in Egypt. Today, there are a few hundred. They completely evacuated Egypt, coming back into the promised land. What about Hamath? This is modern day Syria. In 1948, there were 15,000 Jews. Today, there are 100 in that entire nation state. Then we have Elam, which is modern day Iran. They went from 95,000 Jews in 1948 to 25,000 Jews. Basically cut in a quarter the amount of Jews that are still there. So what we're seeing is this prophecy being predicted in our own day, that they're flooding back from these different nations back into Israel, even the specific nations that Isaiah mentioned. Okay, so Isaiah predicted it. Moreover, Jeremiah predicted it. Jeremiah 31:38. He says, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when the city will be rebuilt for the Lord from the tower of Hananel to the corner gate. The measuring line will go out farther straight ahead to the hill of Gareb. Then it will turn to Goa, verse 40. and the whole valley of the dead bodies and of the ashes and all the fields as far as the brook Kidron to the corner of the horse gate toward the east shall be holy to the Lord. It shall not be plucked up or overthrown anymore forever. So this is going to be a permanent regathering when this happens. Can't be the second first regathering under Ezra and Nehemiah, because it's actually describing a permanent one in the future. Well, these territorial lines that Jeremiah predicted were not used in ancient times for the city of Jerusalem. Today, however, in Israel, these are the exact territories that are used for the city. John Walvoord, in his book Israel and Prophecy, writes, it is predicted that Israel will return to the land and that Jerusalem will be built in a certain area which had formerly never been used for building purposes. It is remarkable that this precise area has been built into a portion of the modern city of Jerusalem in fulfillment of this prophecy. So Jeremiah actually specifically predicts the correct territories. So Isaiah predicts it. Jeremiah predicts it. And then Ezekiel predicts it. Ezekiel 37:11, we read, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Ezekiel gets this vision of all these bones coming to life and their sinews and joints and muscles and skin start to build on them. So it's not an immediate regathering, but slowly being reanimated into its former self. Verse 12, God says, I will bring you into the land of Israel. We're going to have the land again. I will put my spirit within you and you will come to life and I will place you on your own land. He's talking about the real estate, the land, the territory. This is not some kind of spiritual prophecy. It's literal. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken and done it. Verse 21, behold, I will take the sons of Israel from among the nations where they have gone, and I will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land. How many times is he going to say the word land? A lot, apparently. From all sides, from all over, from all nations. It's going to be a global regathering. Verse 25, they will live on the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, in which your fathers lived, and they will live on it, they and their sons, and their sons' sons forever. And David, my servant, will be their prince forever. David is seen as a type of the Messiah. What the Old Testament prophets do not mean is that David will come back to life, but that David, the one to whom the prophecy was given, that on his throne a king will live forever, 2 Samuel 7:11 and following, David becomes a type, a foreshadowing of the Messiah. So when David pops up in the Old Testament at the end of human history, they're talking about the Messiah. Same thing is seen in Jeremiah 23. So Isaiah predicted it, Jeremiah predicted it, Ezekiel predicted it, and then Hosea predicted it. Hosea 3:4, we read, for the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Let's break this down clause by clause, word by word. Okay, he says the sons of Israel will remain for a while, many days, he doesn't say how long, without king or prince. In other words, he's saying the nation of Israel will remain without a political ruler. There will be no king in Israel for a long amount of time. Moreover, he writes, without sacrifice or sacred pillar. Not only is the nation going to be without a political ruler, they're not going to have a religious ruler either. And he also points out there at the bottom, without ephod or household idols. Commentators are back and forth on what this means. My view is that this is probably either referring to the priestly garments, which would be in support of sacrifice and sacred pillar, or it's referring to idolatrous worship, idol worship. The words ephod and household idols could also be referring to idol worship. In other words, there'll be no political ruler, no religious practice. They won't even have idolatry in this land. The Jews will be completely separated. Verse 5, afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, same thing, Messiah, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Okay, so they're going to be without political ruler, without religious rule. Then they're going to come and return and seek the Lord their God, religious restoration. And then they're going to seek David their king, political restoration. Well, when's all this going to happen? He said many days. How long is Israel going to have to wait for this to happen? Well, he says that this is all going to happen in the last days. From that, we can infer at the end of human history as we know it. That's when the nation is going to be rebuilt, brought back together, both politically and religiously. So Isaiah predicted it. Jeremiah predicted it. Ezekiel predicted it. Hosea predicted it. And many more prophets, Zechariah, other prophets predicted this as well. A global regathering of the nation of Israel at the end of human history. But perhaps most importantly of all, Jesus Christ predicted it in Luke 21:24. In his so-called Olivet Discourse, he says they, the Jews, will be brutally killed by the sword or sent away as captives to all the nations of the world. So Jesus predicted the global dispersion of the Jews in AD 70. He predicted that. That was a couple decades off. Well, maybe the Gospels were written after the fact. Well, maybe they put those words back on the lips of Jesus. I think that's nonsense to think that. Let's just say it's true. Let's say Luke wrote these words that Jesus said after 70 AD, so it made it seem like Jesus had a real ability to predict things in advance. But he says that they're going to be going into all the nations of the world. But then he says, and Jerusalem will be conquered and trampled down by the Gentiles until the age of the Gentiles comes to an end. So what does that imply? It implies that the Gentiles are going to take over Jerusalem until their time is done, which implies that they're going to get that land back. See, Jesus was a faithful Jew. He believed in these Old Testament prophecies that Israel was going to be regathered at the end of human history. He predicted the exact same thing. Well, some people see this prophecy and they ask themselves, wait a minute, regathering of Israel, how do we know that this was not a self-fulfilled prophecy? What if just a bunch of Jews were reading their Hebrew Bible and they saw these prophecies that they're supposed to get their land back? And so they read those and then they just got some religious fervor and they got everyone all excited and then they just stormed back in and took their land back. And that's how this whole thing happened. It was a self-fulfilled prophecy. You believe that? I don't. Let me give you six reasons why that's not a good theory. First thing we can point out is that the Roman government usually didn't scatter nations. They conquered them. The Roman government typically didn't disperse a nation globally. Instead, what they would do is they'd just come in and occupy them. That's why you read in the four Gospels that the question of the day was, should we give tribute, should we give taxes to Caesar? And the different Jewish schools of thought brought that before Jesus to trap him. And Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, so on and so forth. After the Maccabean revolt in 160 BC, where the Jews kicked the Greeks out of Israel, okay, they fought them about 5-1, booted the Greeks out. About 100 years later, in 63 BC, the Romans came in and took over Israel. They saw what had happened to the Greeks. And they said, you know what, we're not going to try and make the Jews worship the gods of Rome. We're going to let them have their temple, let them have their worship, let them do their own thing. We're going to take a hands-off, a laissez-faire approach, let them do their thing. As long as they pay taxes to Caesar, they're going to put a Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, over the nation of Israel, and he's going to be in charge of getting that money back to Caesar. The Romans' typical policy was just to leave the country installed, and then they would just have them pay taxes. What's interesting is, in 70 AD, after the Jewish War, the Romans came in with their legions, decimated Israel, in the Bar Kokhba revolt in 132, 135, when Bar Kokhba led a revolt, he was supposed to be the Messiah. When he led a revolt, the Romans came in and smashed him down. And they said, any Jew who steps foot on this territory is going to be hanged and killed. So the Jews were forced to leave Israel, which was not the common practice of Rome. Did they self-fulfill that part of the prophecy? We want to fulfill God's word so much that we're willing to lose over 1 million men, as Josephus puts it, in the Jewish war. It's ridiculous. Second, the Jews have not regathered once, but twice. So think about the improbability of regathering, how difficult that would be. To retain your political and religious identity, your ethnic identity, by being separated throughout all of these different nations and brought back together. The Jews didn't do it once, they did it twice. The first time under Ezra and Nehemiah, and the second time in the 20th century, which we've all witnessed. Third, other nations have tried to regather and they failed. When people espouse this objection, I usually ask them, if it's so freaking easy to be globally dispersed and brought back together, why has no other nation been able to do this? If it's that simple to self-fulfill prophecies like this. Here's what Robert Newman writes. This is in his Jets article, Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society. He writes this on page 91. What are the probabilities that a people group will be globally dispersed, yet retain its identity for centuries independently of a homeland, survive almost continual persecution and harassment, and then return to reestablish their nation? I don't know what the probabilities for that are, but they're probably pretty high. Newman goes on. Few of the peoples from Old Testament times survive today as distinct ethnic groups. The people of Moab, Edom, Nabatea, Philistia, and Assyria have all disappeared. Have you ever met a Moabite? When's the last time you bumped into someone from Edom? They're all completely gone. They've disappeared into the warp and woof of history. He says they've all disappeared, blending with successive migrations of Arabs and others into the area. Coptic, pre-Islamic, Egyptians and Samaritans survived, but they stayed within or close to their homelands. See, there's a difference there. Okay, they have survived after being occupied by a foreign nation and kicked out, but they were close. They were in the same geographic region. The Jews were globally dispersed, far different. Given the upheavals in the Near East, only about a tenth of these people groups have maintained their ancient ethnic identity in the region over the centuries. This is not like the situation in the Balkans or the former Soviet Union, where an amalgam of hostile people groups has fragmented after a century of subjugation. It's not the same at all. Rather, we have a global dispersion of small, relatively isolated communities in foreign lands that nonetheless preserved their identity for thousands of years. Then he says, perhaps the closest analogy would be if the Amish or Mennonite communities returned to their European homelands and formed a new nation, though these have only a 500-year history. The Jews were globally dispersed for over roughly 2,000 years and brought everything back together. Fourth, the Jews regathered despite horrific persecution. You know, some people think that anti-Semitism began in Nazi Germany in 1939. False. False. It was throughout the Inquisition. It was throughout Europe for centuries leading up to World War II. Jews were globally attacked with these conspiracy theories that they were in charge of all the money and everything worldwide. Hitler killed 6 million Jews in World War II. That's how many have been killed. I mean, it's not just that they were globally dispersed and then brought back together. They were globally dispersed and hunted down and thrown into ovens and tortured and killed. That's how unlikely this would be to be fulfilled. Fifthly, when the Jews tried to regather, they failed. Did they self-fulfill this prophecy? They tried to. Every time they tried to regather, they failed. instead, secular nations like the USSR voted for the regathering. If you do study on the history of modern Zionism, this movement to get the Jews back into a nation state, it was countries like the USSR, an atheistic conglomerate of nations. Do you think they were trying to self-fulfill Bible prophecy? That's ludicrous. But these nations were the ones who voted for this regathering, not the Jews. Unless you're one of those conspiracy nuts who thinks the Jews are in charge of the world and pulling all the strings. Sixth and finally, Israel is largely secular, not religious. If you study the subject of modern Zionism, one of the central figures of that movement was Theodor Herzl, who is a secular Jew. It's hard to say when you study his life whether he even believed in God or not. He was not a religious Jew. This movement was largely secular, not religious. They were not trying to fulfill Bible prophecy. They were just trying to save their own skins. There was nowhere for them to go. They were being persecuted, hunted down in their homes. They wanted a nation. And if you talk to modern day Jews, they refer to Herzl as their Ben Franklin. He's their Thomas Jefferson. And even today, if you go to Israel, it's largely secular. Very few Orthodox Jews in that nation. I could also point out that Ezekiel 11:17 and 36:26 predict that at the end of history, the Jews will not be religiously close with Yahweh. So this whole thing's been predicted. I had a guy argue with me about that. He comes from an amillennial perspective. He doesn't think any of this is literally fulfilled. It's figurative. It's fulfilled in the church. And he said, what would God want with a nation of secular Jews? I said, I don't know, but that predicts it right there. And it says that they're all going to come to God at the end of history. He's moving toward a nation, just like in the Old Testament. Okay, second objection. Aren't these passages referring to the first regathering of Israel? First point we could make is that this final regathering is supposed to be permanent. Amos 9, a number of other passages say that when God brings this regathering together, it's going to be final and permanent. Now, if they were referring to the first regathering under Ezra and Nehemiah in 500 BC, then that would mean that these passages turned out to be false because they were dispersed again in 70 AD. So because some of these passages refer to a permanent regathering, that doesn't work. Secondly, some predictions occur after the first regathering. For example, Jesus, definitely after the first regathering. Luke 21:24. He was about 500 years past the first regathering. And Zechariah, I think it's Zechariah 10:8, where God says, I will whistle and call all of you back to the nation. Zechariah 9 through 14 is all about, well, the first coming of Christ, and then it flashes forward to the end of human history. And so Zechariah is post-exilic, post-exile. He's writing after the first regathering, and he predicts it. Third, some predictions refer to every Jew being back in the land. Isaiah 27:12. There's many others that say all the Jews will be regathered. That didn't happen under the first regathering. It hasn't happened yet, but it's in process of happening. And then fourth and finally, some predictions mention a worldwide regathering. Isaiah 11, Isaiah 43, Isaiah 66. This is not talking about the local, isolated regathering under Babylon. It's talking about a global, universal regathering at the end of human history. So there's just four interpretive rules we could offer for why some of these passages are not referring to the first regathering at all. Well, there we have five different non-messianic prophecies. Do we have any questions? Let's pause for questions on anything we covered there. Okay, so the question is, didn't you say that a lot of these prophecies refer to the last days, but doesn't the Bible also use that to refer to just kind of the current day? What's interesting is that if you look at all those passages for the regathering of Israel, what you have is that they're found in Ezekiel 37, that there's going to be a political regathering of Israel, described by a process. First, it's the bones, then the sinews and joints, then the muscle, then the skin, then I'll breathe my spirit into them. So they'll be physically regathered, and then the spiritual part will come in second. And then you have chapter 38, 39, and 40 describing the end of human history, where there's this battle, which Ezekiel refers to as the Battle of Armageddon. And then 40 through 48, and really to the end of the book, there's this rebuilt temple and this whole thing. So what you have is a chronological sequence, which is about the end of human history. Isaiah 11 is the same way. What we have there is in Isaiah 11, it's describing that the Messiah will come like a shoot from the stem of Jesse. And then it'll go into this whole idea of the whole entire nation being brought back together. And then Isaiah 12 and 13 describe this battle of Armageddon. And then finally, restoration, chapter 14, where the lion will lay down with the lamb. So in each one of these passages, it not only refers to the end of history, but it gives a chronological sequence which correlates with one another and moves toward this final conclusion. Yeah. But what you bring up is an interesting point. Some skeptics will look at Bible prophecy and they'll say, well, some of these things have been fulfilled, but then other things haven't been fulfilled. So the Bible is really not that good in its predictions because only some of the things in Scripture have been fulfilled. Well, we would just come back and say, haven't been fulfilled yet. It's on its way. Since we've already seen the down payment in this regard, we're expecting to see the fulfillment in the other regard. So I think that's one of the best arguments that critics give, but we can just come back and say we have good reason to believe the rest of it will be fulfilled. Yeah. That's a very good question. So the question is, I believe it's in Isaiah 11. It says, on that day, the nation of Israel will be regathered. The Hebrew word yom is used there for day. The Hebrew word yom is used roughly 1,900 times in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible. 97% of the time, it refers to a literal 24-hour period. But what we find there in Isaiah 11 and other times in the Scripture, that the term yom actually refers to an entire epoch or long period of history. So one example would be Psalm 90, verse 3, where Moses in his psalm, he says that yesterday, yom, in your sight is like 1,000 years, O Lord. Then in Hosea 6, where Hosea says that on the second day, something will happen, on the third day, we'll be brought back. He's saying second day, not a 24-hour period, but that period, a time period, and then the third day, they'll be regathered and raised. And he's referring to a big era of history. Now, if you're familiar with the different schools of eschatology, some people are amillennial, some people are premillennial. When the term day is used, if you're premillennial, then you must think that that refers to a 1,000-year period, the day of the Lord. If you're amillennial, then you believe that the word yom refers to an eternal period, an eternity. But either way, the term is used of a big stretch of time, not just a 24-hour period. Was that overkill? I'm sorry. Yeah. I've heard that, too. It's possible. Some people have asked me, there is current debate today in our current administration where they were thinking about moving the line back to pre-1967, which is the Six-Day War. And our President Obama has been calling on the Jews, at least it was about a year ago, to move the boundaries back. Whereas before 67, the Israelites had a quarter of the territory they have today. But in the Six-Day War in 67, they quadrupled their territory. And so the question was, if they moved the territory back past Jerusalem, would that invalidate this prophecy? And I would say no. All we know is that at the end of history, it will be finally regathered. But in the meantime, it hasn't been. So if those boundaries went back, that would be okay, too. All we know is that at the end of history, it will finally happen.